Well, ladies and gentlemen, it is that time once again. Welcome to the Veterans Radio Podcast. Cyrus Raymond here from the Legal Help for Veterans Studio in Northfield, Michigan. Just want to thank you for clicking on the download button on today's show. And would also like to thank podbros.com for having this podcast on their website. Head to their page and check out many other great podcasts. But until then, let's take it back to Dale Thronberry right here on Veterans Radio Podcast.
All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Veterans Radio on this beautiful fall, spring day almost. I think we're almost at 50 degrees. Snow is melting like crazy, and everybody's feeling really good. The sun is wonderful, finally. And we're on daylight savings time, so if you're thinking that you're going to be listening to somebody else who should be on now, check your clocks. Remember, you're supposed to spring forward. We've got a great program for you today. I can't wait to get to our guests. Coming up in just a little bit, we're going to have Phil Clay, and Phil has written a book called Redeployment. It's a collection of short stories, fictional stories, of veterans coming back from Iraq. He is a graduate of Dartmouth College and a veteran of the United States Marine Corps. He served in Iraq's Anbar province from January 2007 to February 2008 as a public affairs officer. After being discharged, he went to Hunter College, received a Master of Fine Arts. His story, Redeployment, was originally published in Grantham, I'm not sure what that is, but I'll find out, and is included in Fire and Forget, Short Stories from the Long War. Now, I understand that. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, Crowded Tin House, and elsewhere. In 2014, his short story collection, Redeployment, was shortlisted for the Frank O'Connor Prize and won the National Book Award for Fiction. He was also named the National Book Foundation 5 Under 35 honoree in 2014. Wow, I'm impressed. Phil, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, let's talk about redeployment. It says in your bio that you were a public affairs officer. Tell me a little bit about. I know that some of the stories in there have to be related to what you did while you were in Iraq.
Well, none of the characters are me necessarily. There's 12 different narrators, and they're guys doing a lot of different jobs. You know, mm-hmm. one story is told by an infantryman, one's told by a foreign service officer, another by a chaplain, by a mortuary affairs specialist. So, you know, I think the main thing that being a public affairs officer did in terms of relation to the book was it meant that I ended up spending a lot of time with a lot of different types of Marines and soldiers and sailors. So I was very aware of the wide array of things that people did overseas.
Yeah, I would say. And your stories reflect that. As you mentioned, there's 11 stories in the book from all different. They're all Marine stories, but they're all, you know, different activities and different assignments and so forth. And there's more than one of them in there that are going to bring tears to your eyes if you read them, folks. I encourage you to check out this book, Redeployment. It kind of goes along the lines of the Tim O'Brien and the Things They Carried genre, I guess you could say, of these stories that are just so powerful to me. How did you decide to start writing these stories? Were these things that you had thought about before, or were you a writer before you went into service?
Well, I always written stories. I'd never written about war before. And then I was in Iraq during the surge, so from January 2007 to February 2008. And I came back and I started writing a couple months after I got back. And I think, you know, there were two things. One, you get back from overseas and there's this sort of sense of, okay, you know, what was that? And for me, it wasn't just what was that I experienced, but it was also, you know, what people that I'd known had gone through that I was mm-hmm. thinking about. And the other thing, which I think a lot of veterans felt when they came back, it didn't seem like there was enough conversation about the wars. And I wanted very much to communicate with other people about it, not just veterans, but also civilians, and start a conversation. And for me, writing short stories is a way to say things that can't be said in any other way.
Well, I would agree with you. I was reading another book in a couple of weeks that was actually about Vietnam, and some of the stories in there struck me as being similar. They're just the everyday activities that these men had to go through, but nobody has a clue back here of what they had to go through. And so, so when they get home, they're trying to figure out what the heck did I just do? And how do I fit back into this, this civilization that sent me off to fight these wars. And now they say, okay, fine, you're home. Now go off and get a job and you'll be fine.
Right.
It doesn't sound like a lot of people are fine exactly, at least not right away.
Yeah, I think there's a period of adjustment, right? I think, I would say most vets probably feel like their time in service, left them stronger.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's a strange and difficult transition to leave the military, even if you're not, even if you haven't been through combat, right? Because it's just such a different culture,
mm-hmm.
Military culture versus civilian culture. And, add on to that, if you've been in combat or, many different things that can happen to you in the military and making that transition back into a civilian life.
I was thinking as you were talking, that some of the books that you had read at the back in your acknowledgments, you talk about some of the other books that you had just read to see to get information from, and many of these people have been on our program, thankfully, and in fact, the one at the very bottom is Kayla Williams, Love My Rifle More Than You. I think that we put her on back in 2003 or 4.
Oh, fantastic, yeah.
And Bing West, of course, with His Strongest Tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just amazing. These stories that you have written in here, as I said before, are so powerful in so many ways, when you're looking at the different jobs that these men had over there, and you talk about one, at the beginning of the book, where you're talking about, the first chapter starts off, or the first words in the first chapter are "We shot dogs." Could you talk a little bit about that guy?
Yeah. So that is the opening story. It's actually the first story I wrote, and those words are the first words that I wrote in the book. And that narrator has been through the Second Battle of Fallujah, which is the most intense urban combat that the Marine Corps had been through since Way City, and. Mm-hmm. I'd known a couple guys who had the experience of shooting dogs to stop them from eating human corpses. And, I'm a dog person myself. And it was just an image that stayed in my mind. And I wanted to think about what it would feel like to come home, right? To come home from an environment that's like that. And I remember talking to a friend of mine about just the intensity of the experience and the ways in which even the way that he experienced the world around him kind of shifted. And I wanted to think about that and how difficult it might be or just how strange it might feel to come home.
He comes home and his old dog is not doing well at all. I don't want to give it away, but you need to know, folks, if you're going out to buy Redeployment, it's pretty graphic and the language is pretty colorful, as they say, which is how Marines and most people in the military talk. But I don't think you'll be offended by it because the words just, they just give the message that you're supposed to get. And I think that one really got my attention. It was one of those things that when I finished reading that one, I go, oh, I got to read the next one now, see what this guy's up to. So I thought that was pretty kind of cool. So of other stories that you talked about, which ones did you feel were the hardest to write?
They were all hard in different ways. And it's it's not always necessarily the ones that you would expect that were the most difficult, because you know, for example, there's a story in there which is from the perspective of a Foreign Service officer, and it's you know, it's the most comic of the stories. But it also, you know, to do the research for that, and it's like, you know, there's a character who's trying to teach kids how to play baseball in Iraq, and there's all this absurdity, and but doing the research for that involves reading a lot of Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction reports and thinking very deeply about some of the mistakes that were made early on, particularly early on in the war. And, you know, it's, you know, the story's satirical and, you know, kind of funny. But if you think about it from the perspective of a soldier or a Marine, you know, bad policy decisions, absurd policy decisions made in the context of wartime aren't just absurdities. They're things that can actually get people killed. And so, you know, while the story itself is kind of comic and satirical, doing the research for that was just enraging, because I just go through reports after reports of a lot of the, you know, just sort of gross waste that happened, particularly very early on in the war.
Yeah, there's a lot of waste of time and energy and money.
Yep.
For a lot of these projects, and I know that, you know, that you have, and I'm, you know, you get some officers somewhere or civilians somewhere higher up in the echelon, and they come up with this idea, and they say, oh, this would be kind of cool to do. Let's see if we can get, you know, these kids in Iraq to play baseball. Well,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Provided uniforms and everything else, and the poor guy who's, you know, the public affairs officer is getting, you know, just trying to get water to people. And,
right.
And, you know, trying to get women jobs and so on and so forth. So it's fascinating to me how you were able to weave the various parts of that story all together. And, you know, it came out with an absurd ending, but it's still a good story.
Thank you. Thank you.
Again, I like all of these. You know, even the ones that got me upset. You know, and you're talking about one. We've got about 4 minutes till we have to take a break, Phil. We're talking with Phil Clay, the author of Redeployment. It's a collection of short stories about his experiences in Iraq and his fertile imagination of the people that he was, probably some people that he talked to, you know, put a little memory in the back of your brain and said, oh, that's kind of a cool story. I wonder what I can do with that one. But that's, and you can find more information about his book. He's got all kinds of things on his website. That's philclay.com. Clay is K-L-A-Y .com, philclay.com. And if you want to know about him and so forth, I think you'll find it really important. Let's talk about a little bit about the bodies one. We'll get that one done, so we'll come back on the other side. We don't have to do about the poor guy with the bodies in the mortuary science. How did you come up with that one?
Well, I had known a couple of mortuary affairs Marines when I was in Iraq. It was a job that I, you know, found interesting. It's a hard job, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So I also read a book by Jessica Goodell, called Shaded Black. She did that job when she was in Iraq, and that was just me trying to think about, what that would feel like being, you know, being one of the Marines whose job is to process the bodies of the fallen. A difficult emotional job. And, you know, how that might affect this character and what this person has gone through, I thought it was something I wanted to spend time with, and that I thought would allow me to think about some of the other aspects of war and redeployment that might leave someone a little disoriented, which is certainly the position that character's in at the end of his time.
Well, I would certainly agree with that.
Yeah. And the other thing that story is about is him trying to tell the story of what he's been through when he gets home. And I think, you know, one of the things that happens is you go overseas and you come back to all these ideas that people have about what it is to be a veteran and what you must have done. And, of course, his war stories are not the typical war story, you know. His stories are something very different, and you know, how does he find a way to talk about that, or, you know, sometimes he fails to talk about it.
Yeah, I was looking through that earlier today, and I was just going, how do these men do these jobs? And again, when I was in Vietnam, that was people that did the same job. I can only imagine that they must be the ones that have nightmares. Phil, what we mentioned before, you know, we talked about you shot dogs, and now we've gone through the mortician, and we've gone through the money trying to figure out how to save the Iraqi economy and so forth. Of the stories that we haven't talked about, which one would you like to talk about?
We could talk about the artillery story if you want.
Okay, let's talk about 10 Clicks South. So tell me what happened there.
So it's about an artillery unit. And a lot of the artillery units in Iraq did infantry technicians. But we did have, we had batteries in Iraq, and this one set at Camp Fallujah, right? One of the big forward operating bases in Anbar province. And it's about their first actual mission. So they've been in Iraq for 2 months, and they've shot illumination missions because, the grunts usually don't want to risk collateral damage, and their gun hasn't fired at the bad guys yet, but they have their first mission. And so, the main character is on the loading team, and they do their job, they do it well, and then they're in the chow hall afterwards talking about it. And of course, because they're in a forward operating base and very safe position, they never see the effects of their fire.
Mm-hmm.
So they're trying to figure out what their responsibility is for what just happened, and what relationship they're supposed to have to it, and did we kill anybody? And if so, how many did each of us kill? And they do the math, and they figure out it's 0.6 something people per person. And then the main character goes on, and he basically wants to try and be able to get out there and see what happened, and he never does.
He wants to see what he did.
Right.
And you can understand, I can somewhat understand that idea, and I guess a frustration, because throughout the book you keep bringing up the idea that, Marines, their number one function throughout their training is to kill the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
And so here they are, and their NCOs and officers and stuff are saying, you gotta kill, and you finally, got one, and so, you can feel, more manly or whatever you want to do after you've, you think that you might have killed somebody, and the emotional struggle that I see all of these guys going through, and trying to figure out, did they kill somebody? Did they not kill somebody? And as you pointed out, did they kill a part of a person or all of the person? And those rounds, I'm not an artillery guy at all, but I've seen a couple of those shells, and they're about as tall as I am. So it's like, throwing a bus at somebody.
It's a big, powerful weapon, yeah.
And just to try to figure out, I guess it's to legitimize why you're there. And maybe that's one of the things that they're going through.
And, in a strange way, one of the reasons that I was interested in that, in writing that story in the first place, is that their relationship to killing is not what, the infantryman at the outset, right, who brought his rifle up and fired and,
right.
and has, killed the enemy. They're part of an organization, right, that is engaged in war, and they're trying to figure out what their relationship to that is, and they're a little bit more distanced from the end result.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's kind of the relation of most Americans, right? Like, we're all part of a country that's engaged in the use of military force all the time and has been for years. And we have a responsibility toward that, but it's often kind of hazy exactly what that is and how responsible we are and what exactly, the effects of that are, at the tip of the spear.
I was one of the other books that you used, I guess, for your research was on killing.
Mm-hmm.
Dave Grossman's On Killing and On Combat, which you know talks about almost dehumanizes you know the process and how you can make yourself I don't know what the term is, I guess, immune to the true emotional stress of actually shooting somebody.
Yeah, there have been some very interesting, some very interesting pieces of journalism that have come out about killing by soldiers. There was a piece by a Marine in the Washington Post recently called "Haunted by Their Decisions in War" by Thomas Gibbons Neff. I think you know one of the things there's a Kindle single called "The Kill Switch," which is interviews with a bunch of Marines about you know the act of killing and about sort of being trained to do it so you can do it effectively and look after your guys, and then the kind of moral relationship that people have towards that afterwards.
I'm sorry. It takes my breath away sometimes when I think about some of these things that these young men and women are going through, you know, there, because the main reason that you're there in most cases it's not political. It's not that you're there to protect your buddies around you.
It's about service. Yeah.
You know, and everybody comes to that conclusion. You know, not everybody always agrees politically with whatever the conflict happens to be. But once you get into that conflict, your main goal in life is to get out of that conflict alive and bring as many of your friends back with you at the same time. And I think that that's one,
right.
one of the things that everybody goes through.
And to behave honorably.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
I mean,
honorably.
Yeah, there are rules to war, and a lot of people don't seem to think that there are. And we've had people on the program that are talking about the rules of conflict and, you know, we get frustrated with rules of engagement and so on and so forth. But if we didn't have some of those rules, we would be just as bad as the bad guys.
Right.
And that's something I don't think Americans can really tolerate, as much as some of them may say, oh, just go get them all. Well, then we're just, you know,
right.
we're just stooping to the same level.
Yeah, you know, there's a piece in the Times by Timothy Kudo, who served in Afghanistan, and you know, he talks specifically about having his guys radio to him that they see two men digging on the side of the road and can they shoot them? And you know, it's a decision that he has to make and service members. This is one of the things that I really wanted to get across in the book. You know, that you make decisions of huge moral consequence, right? All the characters in my book are making moral decisions constantly. It's not, you know, it's not up to them, do we go to war or not, right?
Right.
You know, that decision is something that is made at the, you know, broader political level that all, you know, Americans have. It's, you know, within their job, within the constraints of, you know, where they are, what they're doing, the people around them, and what the circumstance is. And they're making those decisions, and then they have to, you know, they have to live with them.
And that's the hard part sometimes.
Sometimes it is, yeah.
You know, that's the part that you come back with, and you say, oh, you know, why did I do that? How could I do that? And people have to, and it's just the way people are. You know, people don't like to kill, I don't think. You mentioned when we talked a little bit earlier that you wanted to read a little segment from the book. Which one did you want to read?
Sure. So I'll read a page from the first story.
Okay.
And so this infantryman who's just back from the Second Battle of Fallujah, and it's his first weekend back with his wife.
Okay.
And that I think sets it up enough. So here's an experience. Your wife takes you shopping in Wilmington. Last time you walked down a city street, your Marine on point went down the side of the road, checking ahead and scanning the roofs across from him. The Marine behind him checks the windows on the top level of the building. The Marine behind him gets the windows a little lower, and so on down until your guys have the street level covered, and the Marine in back has the rear. In the city, there's a million places they can kill you from. It freaks you out at first, but you go through like you were trained, and it works. In Wilmington, you don't have a squad, you don't have a battle buddy, you don't even have a weapon. You circle 10 times checking for it, and it's not there. You're safe, so your alertness should be a white, but it's not. Instead, you're stuck in a American Eagle Outfitters. Your wife gives you some clothes to try on, and you walk into the tiny dressing room. You close the door, and you don't want to open it again. Outside, there are people walking around by the windows like it's no big deal. People who have no idea where Fallujah is, where three members of your platoon died. People who spent their whole lives at White. They'll never get even close to Orange. You can't. And so the first time you're in a firefight, or the first time an IED goes off that you missed, and you realize that everybody's life, everybody's, depends on you not screwing up. And you depend on them. Some guys go straight to red. They stay like that for a while, and then they crash, go down past White, down to whatever's lower than, I don't care if I die. Most everybody else stays orange all the time. Here's what orange is. You don't see or hear like you used to. Your brain chemistry changes. You take in every piece of the environment, everything. I could spot a dime in the street 20 yards away. I had antenna out that stretched down the block. It's hard to even remember exactly what that felt like. I think you take in too much information to store, so you just forget. Free up brain space to take in everything about the next moment that might keep you alive. And then you forget that moment, too, and focus on the next, and the next, and the next, for 7 months. So that's orange. And then you go shopping in Wilmington, unarmed, and you think you can get back down to White? It'll be a long time before you get down to White.
Absolutely. And there's still a lot of men and women out there that are on orange for 30, 40, 50 years, it seems, in this particular sense of readiness and awareness of what's around you. And I could relate to that part of your story so well. And I took R&R in Hawaii in 1969, and we were walking down the street, and I just couldn't believe that there were so many people on the street. And then some car backfired or a firecracker or something like that, and I went over a hedgerow, dragged my wife with me. And, it's just the way it was. You were hyper alert. Yeah. And it took a while to come down for that. And as I mentioned before, there are people that are still trying to come down for that. Oh, there we are. After action report. Can you tell me a little bit about this story, Phil?
Sure. So, it's a military police unit, and there are two guys, and one of them ends up shooting a teenager who had, grabbed an AK and started firing at them, right? And so it's justified shooting, but they were in such a position so they could see what happened. And it's the first time anybody in this unit has actually killed anybody. And the one character, the shooter, asks his buddy to say that he had done it. That it was, that he was the one who had killed this kid, because he didn't want to have to answer the questions that he figured people were going to ask him.
And then what happened?
He
gets this guy to cover for him.
Yeah, the guy covers for him, and then he starts answering questions, but also trying to figure out what his friend is going through. And the other odd thing that happens is the other people in the unit, his officer and particularly the staff sergeant, are trying to look out for him, because they know that while, some of the younger guys in the unit are very excited and they're, that he's done this, that maybe they think that the narrator is taking it hard, or maybe he's just having difficulty with it, and they want to make sure that, they're available for him. Except, of course, he's not the one who shot the kid. And so he's trying to get their advice for him so that he can then help out his friend who doesn't really want to talk about it.
You got to read the book, folks. We've left a lot out of the stories, because we don't want to give away the endings of them. But there are many great short stories in there. How did you get started in writing short stories?
Well, I'd always written. You know, it was always, for me, it was the best way I know how to think things through, you know, because I think we experience life through stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always a big reader. I mean, I think that's probably how every writer starts,
is
as a big reader. And then I ended up, studying writing in college. And I had a teacher who, when he found out that I was joining the military, he made me read all this great war fiction. So he had me read War and Peace, and he had me read Hemingway's short stories, and Celine's Journey to the End of the Night, and Davy Jones and Princess, and just a lot of the great war fiction, that's been written. And so I ended up, going to the military with a pretty strong basis of knowledge in, you know, literature about war. And then I just kept reading and kept thinking about war while I was in the military. And of course, you know, the Marine Corps, you're supposed to be doing reading anyway to you know, improve yourself as an officer. So that process continued.
Can you tell me how you got involved with the Veterans Writing Workshop at NYU? I think this sounds like a great thing.
Oh, it's fantastic. Ambassador Gene Kennedy Smith had set this up with NYU to provide a space for veterans, free for veterans to come. We met on weekends, and it's still going on, and talk about writing. And it wasn't, you know, wasn't supposed to be a political thing, you know, just to focus on the craft of writing, right? It didn't have any particular agenda other than trying to help veterans tell their stories. And so we would, you know, meet every Saturday, and people are still meeting this great community of veteran writers in New York. And so while I was working on these stories, I was also meeting with other veterans and talking to them about war and about writing about war. And it was really just a remarkable experience.
Well, it sounds like a great program, and it sounds like there's a lot of copycat type of programs going on around the country trying to encourage our veterans to sit down and either write their stories, either nonfictional or fictional. And I found that, even though I'm not a writer, I have found that just talking about some of these things on their program has helped me, you know, get rid of some of the demons that were hanging out back there in the back of my mind every once in a while that didn't jump forward. So what's next for Phil Clay?
Just keep writing. You know, I mean, that's what I love to do. And so that's what I'm going to try and do. Just see if I can keep doing it.
Do you have any books in the future, or what's going on?
So I'm slowly working on a novel. We'll see how that goes. It's kind of hard to talk about now because it's in the pretty early stages. But yeah, I'm working on a novel.
Is this one of the things where you just kind of write, put it down, and write, put it down, and come back to it? How do you write?
So, you know, the way that I write involves a lot of research. I'm always, you know, I'm not trying to. I'm interested in a lot of the things that I don't know. I'll put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, writing is very much a process of, you know, reading a lot of books, interviewing people. I also, you know, would write this thing in stages. So I have, you know, some good friends who are good writers who would read my work, you know, while I was working on it. I'd have civilians and veterans read the work. So I see how both sides were interpreting what I was putting down on the page.
Well, that's always good to have, you know, people critique what you're writing and say, you know, that's a good way of putting it or not a good way of putting it. You know, when you joined the Marines, you had just graduated from Dartmouth when you went into the Marines?
Yes.
What made you choose the Marines? You like the uniforms. I understand that part, but
they do have the best uniforms. That much is definitely true. I like the ethos of the Marine Corps. I like the way they presented themselves. My older brother had joined the Marines. He was a combat engineer, and I just, you know, I, the reason I joined was because we were at war, right? So that's, and you know, it just seemed like the thing to do, I guess. That being a Marine would be the right way to go and the best way to serve my country.
Well, it's very appreciated what you have done in the book that you have written. Do you live in the New York area?
I do. I live in Brooklyn.
Okay. Well, that's where. All right. There's an organization that I don't know if you've heard of it or not, called the Military Writers Society of America. And it's a whole bunch of authors from all over the country that sit down and you know, write military stories and critique each other's work and so on and so forth. And I think it might be, you know, somebody that you might be interested in talking to at some point.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're pretty cool. And their president lives in Brooklyn. So that's when I thought about it. It was that. So we've been talking to Phil Clay today, author of Redeployment, National Book Award winner. Mm-hmm. It's a group of short stories about men doing their service in Iraq, 2007-2008. I strongly encourage all of you to get out there and to buy and read this book. I think it's something that you're going to really enjoy, and it's going to be one of those books that you're going to pass along, because that's what I'm going to be doing, is passing this along. There are people that need to read this. So, Phil, I want to thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio.
Thank you so much.
It is truly my pleasure, and we'll talk to you again soon, I hope.
All right.
Thank you.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.